We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, April 24th, and this is the last week of the Supreme Court's oral arguments for their term, and then decisions are expected to be out no later than the end of June. So this week has been a very busy week in the Supreme Court, so we're going to spend a little bit of time today talking about a couple of those very important arguments since the last few days we've been talking about other things that have been going on in Congress, and the coordinate branches of government on the federal level are all very busy, and I think it would be better for a lot of us if they weren't so busy, but that's the way that it goes these days. And the Supreme Court heard on Monday, so we'll just kind of go in order, because Monday and then today and tomorrow are three of the biggest and probably most interesting cases of this term. Other than, a few that we've talked about previously, obviously, but we'll just start in order. So Monday, the court heard oral arguments in City of Grants Pass versus Johnson. And this was a really interesting case because it contemplated whether homelessness it cannot be criminally punished by a city. So this was a city in Oregon that has a large portion of homeless people. And the argument, according to the Ninth Circuit, which the Supreme Court then heard the appeal from that argument, took a case from about 100 years ago and that precedent to suggest that homelessness is a status that cannot be punished under the Constitution, and they invoked the Eighth Amendment to say that it was cruel and unusual punishment to punish people for being homeless when that was no fault of their own, and they had no alternatives to find shelter. And then, of course, the appellants in that case were saying, well, of course, it is not a constitutional right to have shelter, and the government doesn't need to provide a shelter, and of course can punish if you sleep on the street. So the arguments became very interesting, and the reason this matters is because the left so often will not only manipulate themselves into pretzels when they are trying to push arguments and reinvent the Constitution and its language, but they also will use the arguments then in the public policy sphere to suggest, for example, that homelessness is something that the government should cure. And this goes all the way back to then the rise of the bigger administrative state and how the left's entire agenda is to have everyone basically reliant on government handouts, not own property, not have ownership over anything that they do, but live in government subsidized housing, be so dependent on the government that you end up voting Democrat, and we have this complete bifurcation of the elites and the plebeians, basically. And so you have this class warfare that is ultimately grounded in Marxism. And that's the entire point, is to make it the oppressor and the oppressed, and a government in this instance, of course, being the savior that comes in and is helpful. And so this is what the left has been pushing in the aftermath of this argument that happened on Monday. But the legal issue that is also very important to understand from this case is that if homelessness is a status that is not able to be punished. And there was this very weird and interesting argument that that the leftists are trying to push to the court, that there's a difference between status versus conduct. And so they invoked a historical Supreme Court precedent that said, for example, if you are a drug user, then you cannot be punished for just merely being, for example, an alcoholic, only if you use drugs or alcohol and a conduct that particular act itself can be criminally punished. But you can't be punished just based on your status of being a drug addict. And so they're trying to then equate homelessness as a status to being a drug addict as a status, and say that because naturally people fall asleep, and that is one of the most human things that we do, you can't punish people for sleeping outside, because eventually if they have nowhere to go, then they will just naturally fall asleep somewhere and they have to sleep, and that is part of humanity. And so you can't punish them for then sleeping on public property, erecting their tents and so forth. So the problem, of course, with this argument for conservatives is that if we get into this spiral of status versus conduct, then what we are choosing to say is a protected status and cannot be criminalized, then we're parsing so finely the difference between status versus conduct, because the moment that someone erects the tent, I mean, that should be the conduct itself of being able to then go and fine them or give them a ticket or so forth. But it's this very leftist framework to suggest that civil rights status of whether it's a drug addict, it's a homeless person, it's a trans person, it's a, you know, leftist, whatever, they're trying to equate status and this notion of a very Marxist interpretation of civil rights, rather than understanding the purpose, the legitimacy of government, and also property rights. Of course, you know, in this instance, we're talking about public property, but at the same time, our tax dollars go to that, and government and local townships should be able to remove people from sleeping on public property. And so this whole idea has become so extreme and so openly extreme from the left that we're now seeing their Marxist ideology infiltrate a lot of their oral arguments. And we have a clip from the exchange between the attorney who was arguing on behalf of the city, saying, you know, homelessness should be able to be punished and the city should be able to take care of that issue. And Justice Sotomayor saying, well, you know, you're not punishing people, for example, who decide to go and have their chair on the beach and they fall asleep in their chair, somebody who falls asleep on a park bench in the middle of the afternoon when they're reading. And of course, there's a very big difference between someone erecting a tent and sleeping there regularly versus somebody who's just simply, you know, taking advantage of the nice weather. But that point, of course, was entirely lost on Justice Sotomayor. But listen to this. This is cut two.
Assuming it's there, it prohibits you criminalizing homelessness, right? So what you do is say only homeless people who sleep outdoors will be arrested. That's the testimony of your chief of police, two or three officers, which is, if you read the crime, it's only stopping you from sleeping in public if you, for the purpose of maintaining a temporary place to live. And the police officers testified that that means that if a stargazer wants to take a blanket or a sleeping bag out at night to watch the stars and falls asleep, you don't arrest them. You don't arrest babies who have blankets over them. You don't arrest people who are sleeping on the beach, as I tend to do if I've been there a while. You only arrest people who don't have a second home. Is that correct?
Well,
who don't have a home.
So, no, these laws are generally applicable. They apply to...
Yeah, that's what you want to say. Give me one example, because your police officers couldn't, and they explicitly said, if someone has another home, has a home, and is out there and happens to fall asleep, they won't be arrested. Fall asleep with something on them.
Well, Joint Appendix, page 98, is one example of a citation issued to a person with a home address. But more importantly, I think what we're getting at here is that these laws regulate conduct of everyone. There's nothing in the law that criminalizes homelessness. I really
that's
want
what,
to...
That's what you say, but if I look at the record and see differently...
So she's really, Justice Sotomayor was actually comparing somebody who is sleeping regularly on public property, who doesn't have a home to go to a baby sleeping with a blanket over them in public. I mean, this is how absurd sometimes these arguments and convoluted they are, because obviously there is not any sort of comparison between those two instances. And, you know, what this advocate, in my view, should have said is that there should be some sort of not only regularity, but also in terms of the conduct, but also if you go up to someone who's sleeping, maybe on a park bench, and an officer wakes them and they're like, oh, sorry, you know, let me leave, then fine. But someone who doesn't have a home to go back to, then maybe that's at the point where then their conduct, they fall back asleep. I mean, there are such distinctions between the conduct that the government is trying to deal with and regulate versus what the law, if it's so vague and overbroad, isn't designed to capture. But we'll see how the Supreme Court deals with it. And interestingly, if you read the Volcker conspiracy, this is a kind of a newsletter that comes out of Reason, Reason.com, Reason Magazine, which I realize is very, very capital L libertarian. So read it in that framework. And I read the spectrum of everything, right? Because I want to know what different people are saying. But I also always read with some intelligence behind it of understanding, okay, what is this author? What is their perspective? What's their background? What is this publication generally? If it's CNN, for example, versus Fox News versus Reason versus Newsweek, I mean, all of these different things, right? And there are some good people who write for various publications. I mean, I've placed articles in a total variety of outlets, and generally, you know, whoever was willing to take my piece, I'm happy to have it in their outlet, and it didn't really matter. So you have to, you know, read first the outlet, but definitely the author. And the Volcker conspiracy is a really great column. And their tagline even says, mostly law professors, sometimes contrarian, often libertarian, always independent. So there's a variety of mostly law professors that write for this. And Ilya Somlin, who I follow on social media, has some good takes. I don't always agree with him, but, you know, very interesting legal mind. His response to this whole case is that the Eighth Amendment provides little, if any, protection for the homeless. He doesn't get as much into this whole question of status versus conduct, which I think is a critical issue in this case. But his solution is that combating homelessness needs to happen by ending exclusionary zoning restrictions. And it's a really good argument. So if you go to Reason.com and you go to the Volcker conspiracy, I would commend this piece to your reading, because he goes into you know, some of the issues in this particular argument and what some of the justices were saying. But he's also saying that there's a much better way for the administrative state, and there are obvious problems with the administrative state, by combating the whole issue of homelessness, because alleviating that through the Eighth Amendment and saying that jurisdictions and municipalities can't criminalize or enforce not sleeping on public property is ridiculous. Then just exclusionary zoning, which really has been used by the administrative state to prohibit lower income and more affordable housing, would alleviate that problem. And this is exactly why the administrative state tries to, particularly in blue states, enforce exclusionary zoning rules for this exact reason. Because the left, again, doesn't want to make housing affordable. They don't want people to not be homeless. They want everyone dependent on government. And so all of these issues always go back to a root worldview. And in this case in particular, there's a lot of different issues that come out of it. But the main thing is that we need to use government for its legitimate purpose, which is to protect property rights, not just create all of these weird different types of statuses. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies. And that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And Devin, my great producer, and Adam reminded me in the break, they're like, I don't think we're going to get all the way through the week because we've only gotten through Monday at the Supreme Court. So we'll see. But so we'll skip over Tuesday. That was an interesting case that you can read more about, that the Supreme Court appeared to side with Starbucks in a labor dispute issue. That's interesting. But we'll move forward to today. Today at 10 a.m., if you want to listen to the argument online, the case is Idaho versus the United States. And at the heart of this is whether the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, or the EMTALA is probably their acronym, EMTALA, which mandates hospitals to stabilize patients facing life-threatening conditions, regardless of their ability to pay, is in conflict with Idaho state law that has a near total abortion ban. And so whether this EMTLA preempts state laws that protect human life and prohibit abortions, like Idaho's Defense of Life Act. So this is the first major abortion case that has come up to the U.S. Supreme Court since Dobbs. This will have a really important outcome for life. So we need to be praying that the justices side with the Republican Attorney General of Idaho, who is arguing that, of course, and he says this, Idaho law is perfectly consistent with the EMTALA, which provides explicit protections for unborn children in 4 separate places. The notion that the EMTALA requires doctors to perform abortions is absurd. And so this was broken down a little bit more in a piece in Time magazine, and the headline is Supreme Court will hear challenge to Idaho's near total abortion ban. The case marks the second abortion-related challenge to come before the justices following the court's decision in Dobbs. Legal experts anticipate that the court's ruling in the Idaho case could establish a significant precedent regarding whether emergency medical care can be denied to a pregnant woman in distress in order to save the fetus. And obviously, Time is taking, in their reporting, you can see the shading of how they are characterizing that, because the pro-life way to say this would be, of course, whether Idaho's law is consistent with the emergency life-saving protections that the other Idaho statute requires, that there are 2 patients, that in an emergency situation, doctors don't just first jump to abortion as the medically best outcome for the mother, but rather try to save both the life of the mother and the life of the child. But leftists never want to talk about that, and I hope that the advocates who are arguing this case. It's likely the Idaho Solicitor General that will argue this case. I don't know that for sure. We'll see when the oral arguments begin. I'm going to listen to them this morning, and it's at 10 a.m. Eastern. You can go to supremecourt.gov, listen to the live stream there, or I actually prefer to go to C-SPAN. They have kind of a better view, in my opinion, because they always change depending on which advocate or justice is speaking, and so you can follow along a little better, particularly if you're not familiar with the voices of the justices, then you can look at that. Because when I first started listening to the Supreme Court's arguments when Sotomayor and Kagan were both on the bench, I confused them quite often, and they're both liberal, they're both women, you know, so it just happened that way. So that was always very helpful for me, just distinguishing the voices. But I hope that the advocates in this case, whoever is arguing on behalf of Idaho and its abortion ban, are going to point out the fact that emergency life-saving measures require protecting unborn children. And so why should, if we're talking about particularly a constitutional equal protection framework, why would we argue that this emergency medical treatment and labor act would not cover unborn children and would preclude them and only apply to the mother? I mean, that's presuming that unborn children don't have a right to life. They're not persons under the law, particularly under the Constitution and the 14th Amendment in particular. And so that is something that hopefully the justices will contemplate. And so Time Magazine frames it this way, that the justices must decide whether they believe Idaho's law conflicts with the federal EMTLA law. If they do, then the fundamental legal question they will have to consider is whether federal law supersedes state law when the two are in conflict. And so we're probably going to hear a lot about the Supremacy Clause and suggesting that if the federal law is trumping Idaho's near total abortion ban, which is a very good thing, then the federal law should trump that and should supersede that. And this is a way that the leftists are trying to maneuver to get even the really good laws and some of these trigger laws that have now taken effect following the Dobbs decision, to get them overturned by these ridiculous legal maneuvers that create hypotheticals suggesting that doctors are required to perform abortions when there is a life-saving emergency that is on the line for the woman. And that's an absolutely ridiculous notion, particularly in 2024, when we're not talking about, you know, medical advancements as of the 1800s. There are a lot of ways that even very, very tiny, tiny babies can be saved in neonatal care. And so if there is a saving emergency for the mother and delivery of the baby is necessitated, in fact, the doctor should be required to try to save both lives. So this idea that these two are in conflict, I think that the Republican Attorney General of Idaho is right, that this isn't in conflict. And in fact, the federal law is in concert with Idaho's ban, and the justices should construe the federal law to require protections of the unborn child and the mother. So hopefully this entire case backfires on the ridiculous pro-abortion, pro-baby killer leftists who are trying on purpose to undermine all of the red states and the great laws that we have on the books. And speaking of attempts to undermine this, and we'll get to Thursday's case. I know we only have 10 minutes more in this segment, but we'll get to that next case. But speaking of pro-life, Florida's Amendment 4, you may have heard some other shows on AFR already talk about this, but it's a really important one, especially if you, like me, live in the state of Florida. This is now called the Right to Abortion Initiative. And what it seeks to do, and this is according to Ballotpedia, the initiative would provide a constitutional right, we're talking about Florida's state constitution that would be amended, to a constitutional right to abortion before fetal viability, estimated to be around 24 weeks, or which I think that's kind of an overestimation, but because, you know, there's viability is not a bright line. Or when necessary to protect the patient's health as determined by the patient's healthcare provider. The initiative would not change the state legislature's authority to enact a law requiring the parents of a minor to be notified if their child is seeking an abortion with exemptions that can be obtained through judicial waiver. And Governor DeSantis, on a completely separate matter, was answering questions from reporters who asked him about this and saying, well, you know, this wouldn't change the requirement for consent. And he said, no. Consent is a condition precedent to abortion, where notification can happen after the fact. So you have to be very clear and precise in your terms. And so this amendment, while just on face, is absolutely terrible. It would undermine Florida's heartbeat law that was enacted and signed by Governor DeSantis following Dobbs, but then is so vague in its terms as well, that Floridians really don't know what they're amending the Constitution to include. And this is a way that leftists, again, just try to completely undermine all of the advancements of pro-lifers, because they will try to enact these initiatives that are so over vague, and then they go back and they use the terms in arguments and in legal cases to define them however their argument prefers. And we're seeing them do that very explicitly with cases like the Bostock opinion that tried to, and unfortunately was successful in, redefining the term sex in the 1964 Civil Rights Act to also include sexual orientation and gender identity, which was a ridiculous reading of the congressional intent when that statute was enacted. But leftists will go back and they will reinvent terms. And so what a lot of these types of ballot initiatives are attempting to do is to undermine the pro-life advancements in red states. And they're so over vague that then the leftists can come back in, manipulate the language for their advantage. And they're also being absolutely false in their characterization of what the supposed law would contain when they're talking about, and they're trying to substitute these terms like consent versus notification and say, oh, well, they're synonymous. No, they're not. And Governor DeSantis was absolutely right. And the point that he also made, which was a very good one, was if you are not clear on what an amendment actually says and what it would provide in the scope, just vote no. Vote no, because if it's a good thing, we can always recontemplate it later. But if you are not sure, then the status quo should always be voting no. And I agree with that proposition. There are obviously some good ballot initiatives, and iVoter Guide and everything that AFA Action does. In fact, Walker Wildman was on my Salem media show yesterday. You can go wherever you stream podcasts and you can listen to that, because we talked about Amendment 4 and also all the great work that AFA Action does, so that you can be prepared how to best cast your vote. And you should absolutely be looking into these issues before you get your ballot, so that you're not just reading this language under time pressure, or, you know, you're texting a bunch of friends saying, okay, this one I'm not really super clear on, you know, how did you vote? What should I do? Be a responsible citizen by looking into all of the measures, not just the people that the elected officials, but the ballot initiatives and ballot measures before you get your ballot or before you go into vote. And if you're not clear, I think that that's actually very good advice from Governor DeSantis, who is a lawyer, and how he framed that was very good, that just voting no as a status quo is generally a good thing, especially in an era where the left is purposefully in red states attempting to undermine particularly the pro-abortion or pro-life rather advancements from red states. So again, the Supreme Court case this morning is Idaho versus the United States. Be praying for the outcome of that one, and that Idaho would continue to be able to enact their near total abortion ban, which is a very good thing for that state. All right. 4 minutes left in this segment. We'll get to Thursday, which is a really big case. And that, of course, is Trump versus the United States. And we have talked about this at length. So even though I only have 4 minutes in this segment, that's okay. This is, of course, the presidential immunity case. And so it was the DOJ and the special counsel's request to treat the stay application. So they did not want to move forward in the Department of Justice's prosecutions of Donald Trump while there was still this question of whether Trump could raise as a defense presidential immunity. And so the D.C. Circuit, which had that ruling, which was then appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, had a very, in my view, inconsistent ruling of this case compared to what immunity actually should be and how we have always in the legal profession understood immunity to be, where it's the D.C. Circuit made it a matter of time, where they said that presidential immunity attaches for the duration that a president is in office, and then it will lapse after a president is out of office. That doesn't make sense from an immunity standpoint. And the idea that if you have immunity for actual acts under color of your office, then that should not expire, because then you will always have threat of opposition prosecution as soon as you leave office. And presidents, of course, are term limited. So this may be appealing to some legislative members if that type of immunity is then repositioned to the legislature, because they can, you know, continue on in just seeking re-election. But right now, legislative immunity does not work the same way. So I think that the Supreme Court will likely overturn the D.C. Circuit, and should, in this way. I don't think that Trump will ultimately win this argument. And just from a legal standpoint, regardless of all of the other things we could talk about, you know, the prosecutions, the lawfare, the political nature of it, all of that, we need to be concerned about what precedent this sets for future presidents, which could include, after November, Donald Trump. So there needs to be a difference, not just in the timing of when immunity attaches, but the acts themselves. So was Donald Trump, for these alleged acts that the DOJ is prosecuting him for, were those acts under the scope of his official office, where immunity should attach into perpetuity? Or were the acts that the alleged acts that he committed, or that were allegedly criminal, were they in his personal capacity as a candidate for re-election? And that is where I think the Supreme Court is going to focus, and how this will turn. And I think ultimately they are going to decline to allow presidential immunity to be raised as a defense for that purpose, because you know, and Trump, of course, is arguing that that asking these questions about an election was part of his presidential office to ensure the safety, national security of America, all of those things. I don't think the Supreme Court is going to buy that, nor do I think that they should. But this will be interesting, and this will be Thursday morning at 10 a.m. I expect the arguments will go several hours, but you may want to listen. So we got through it all, and we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we got a question in the break from producer Devin asking, so when will we likely have the opinions from all of these cases that we've been discussing this week? And likely that will be in June and in the last days of the term of the Supreme Court. But particularly the Trump immunity case could be sooner than that, just because of the timeline of the prosecutions, but we don't know, and it's entirely up to the Supreme Court. And it's always interesting as sort of a pop quiz every day when the Supreme Court is handing down their opinions, and everybody just waits, and then all of the legal minds rush to read the opinion and comment on it, and it's always a lot of fun. I like to call it legal jeopardy, but yeah, that's a ba-dum-bum. Okay, all right, let's turn to actually a more sobering story. This coming from the Jerusalem Post, and this is talking about the Middle East conflict. This is just a really not good story at all for Israel. And we need to talk about it because Gazans discover a mass grave near Nasser Hospital and the IDF denies involvement. This coming as one of the top generals for Israel's army and the IDF has resigned. And so the Gazans have reported discovering a mass grave with over 200 bodies on Monday near the Nasser Hospital in the Gaza Strip. And so the IDF has rejected the claims in an official statement in response to the report, saying that they are baseless and unfounded because the Qatari-based news outlet Al Jazeera published a report on the matter claiming that Palestinian civil defense members and paramedics have retrieved 300 or so bodies buried in this mass grave by the Israeli military. So where does this position the Middle East conflict? Because even though, of course, I am, and in general, I think that Americans should be pro-Israel and their right to defend themselves, and they, of course, were attacked heinously on October 7th of last year. That doesn't necessarily mean that all acts, if this is true, if this report is true, that everything then that Israel may do in response is necessarily right or in line with the rules of engagement. So joining me now to discuss is Zach Yost, who is with the Mises Institute. So, Zach, what do you make of this story?
Thanks for having me on, Jenna. Yeah, you're exactly right that it is very sobering. It's a horrifying report. I think we need more information to know what the exact situation is. The Israelis have claimed that they exhumed certain bodies to try and identify if they were hostages who had been killed. And both sides, of course, have an interest in painting what happened for, you know, propaganda purposes, and in my experience in a conflict, it's way too early to have any sort of concrete idea of what has happened here. Hopefully we'll get more information as time goes on, but it's definitely very, very bad for Israel's public image, which has been going down a lot since the conflict started, and I would say it in general, it just reflects that Israel's sort of in a very bad long-term geostrategic position in terms of they need American support and young Americans do not support Israel. So this won't do anything to help that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, we're kind of getting off into a tangent for just a moment, but I want to actually dive a little deeper into that sentiment that, you know, young Americans generally aren't supportive of Israel. And we've been talking about that on this program from a variety of perspectives. And I'm very interested in what you attribute that to, because, you know, we've seen that the evangelical movement as a whole, that is unfortunately in large part, I think, aging out and failing to pass on the biblical worldview to a wider swath of young people. And, you know, we can have conversations about how the church should deal with that, doctrinally, all of those things. But it's almost become kind of this aging out perspective that America should support Israel for theological reasons. Now, younger Americans are solely interested in just America first and maybe being pro-Israel as a secondary consideration merely because she is America's ally. What do you attribute that to?
Right. So the Pew Research has a new poll out at the beginning of April, and you're exactly right with the sort of aging sort of take on things. If you look for both U.S. adults in general, Republicans and Democrats, it's exactly that. 65 plus support Israel the most, and then it just goes down like, you know, stairs after that with 18 to 29-year-olds, even Republicans, support Israel 28%. So that's pretty shocking compared to 70% of 65-plus. And I think you hit on it correctly, not to make any theological commentary, but I think that sort of dispensationalism, things like that, is not very popular, or however you want to phrase it, with younger Christians even. There are a lot of right-wing people who aren't even really Christians, even nominally anymore. So it wouldn't factor in even at all for that. It is very sort of an America first. We have all these problems here at home we need to focus on. And then on the left, of course, it, you know, ranges from anti-Semitism to sort of like a woke intersectional identifying all of the woke issues here in America with the Palestinians. So
yeah, and I think you're correct on that, and it's it is very troubling from a theological perspective. And, you know, listeners know I am a dispensationalist Christian, and I think that America should support Israel from a theological proposition and also a foreign policy position from America and Israel being allies. Both of those are simultaneously compatible, and they're not inconsistent. But if we look at the younger generation, I mean, this may be in part why President Trump, as the likely GOP nominee, isn't really making a lot of statements in terms of Israel support. He's been a lot more focused on some other things, which, you know, we may give him a little bit of a pass this week because he's tied up in court and I think focused on all of the lawfare going on in New York. But the U.S. and the U.N. is concerned about this report of the mass grave. And so the U.S. State Department said on Tuesday, this also according to the Jerusalem Post, that reports on mass graves in Gaza were troubling. And the UN rights chief said earlier on Tuesday he was, quote unquote, horrified by those reports. So do we have any assurances at the moment, at least, that these reports actually are accurate? Or could it be possible that this is just propaganda trying to foment more of an anti-Israel sentiment and more of an optics perspective? I mean, what do we know right now about the reliability even of this story?
So there's not a lot of Western media in Gaza. CNN had a staff member who visited the scene and attested that, you know, there's a lot of bodies here. Where those bodies came from, it's acknowledged that Gazans buried people there. It's sort of outside a hospital because they could not get to a cemetery. There are reports, though, that there were bodies in this grave who were basically, it seems, probably just executed. They were sort of, it's reported they, you know, had their hands zip tied and whatnot. We just don't know at this time. I've not seen any sort of photographic or video evidence of what's being alleged here. I'm sure people will be looking into it. Israeli forces have sort of left this area of Gaza, and that's why now people are coming back and seeing this. I would say it's not out of the realm of possibility that this occurred, but it's also not, you know, we don't know at this point.
So we're kind of in just a wait and see posture, and that's always a good thing when there are reports that aren't necessarily verified yet. And I'm speaking with Zach Yost from the Mises Institute about the story that's being reported that Gazans have discovered a mass grave near the Nasser Hospital, and the IDF has denied involvement. So how does this, if at all, then, Zach, complicate the massive aid package that was just passed yesterday out of the Senate and will go to Biden's desk for signature? And, you know, we've been discussing on this show throughout this week that there is billions in aid to Israel, but then also billions in supposed humanitarian aid that Republican members of Congress are saying is going to go to Hamas. And so we're basically funding kind of both sides of the war. Does this change Biden's strategy here, or at least how the White House is going to have to message this?
Yeah, so I don't think really anything could stop this aid package at this point, just because it's so tied together. various issues mound together. But what has been announced is that the U.S. is going to be sanctioning a unit of the Israeli military, and it had nothing to do with this incident here. It's not been declared which unit it is, but Israeli officials are very upset and have been having a lot of calls with American officials, saying you can't do this. It would not be surprising if there were sort of more attempts at these sort of targeted sanctions if this report turned out to be credible. Just in terms of domestic politics, Biden has to juggle a very difficult situation here where he needs Muslim and Arab American votes, especially in Michigan. But he also needs the votes of people who support Israel. And I think he's going to end up sort of sitting on the fence of trying to please both and pleasing no one, which probably wouldn't be very helpful for him come November. But I wouldn't be surprised if he tries to do something to punish Israel, perhaps even if it wasn't verified, just for the sake of doing something. But that I could see more sort of specifically targeted sanctions, we have to see.
And Zach, what about the, and it's Israel's military intel chief, not a general, I misspoke earlier. Israel's military intel chief resigned 2 days ago, citing failures over the October 7th attack. Do you see that as being a consequence of this report specifically, or is it more broad than that?
No, I don't think it has anything to do with this report. October 7th was a complete disaster from the standpoint of the Israeli military and intelligence. It a lot more people would, should be resigning, one would think, after such a failure. So, it was the worst attack in the country's history, really. You would expect a lot more heads would be rolling in terms of the people who were in charge that day.
Yeah. So in just the last couple of minutes we have with you, and I'm speaking with Zach Yost from the Mises Institute about, and you can read more about the report from the Jerusalem Post. And of course, other places, our good friend Joel Rosenberg, who joins me frequently, editor-in-chief of All Israel News, also has some stories up there. But about this, this really important report that hasn't yet been confirmed, but is of course being talked about, that Gazans discover a mass grave, and the IDF is denying involvement. Where should Americans at least focus from here in terms of understanding where this Middle Eastern conflict is going now, especially because I think you're right that nothing is going to stop the aid package?
Yeah, it's the future's radically uncertain. I can say that going back to what we talked about before about, dramatically declining support for Israel among younger Americans, Israel relies on American support. In inflation-adjusted terms, America has given $300 billion in aid to Israel since its founding. And, of course, the United States provides a lot of diplomatic coverage for Israel. So I suspect that the Israelis, they have to be aware of this, the Israeli government, and it could affect how they act now in terms of they might not have the wherewithal to launch certain conflicts or operations that they would now. So notably, there's concern, there's speculation that Israel might launch a large offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon.
And we'll have to see, and Zach, we'll leave it there. But thank you so much for your comments. We're already out of time. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.